Welcome to a really important episode of the Good Glow podcast with Sarah Grace. Sarah is someone who I only recently came across, and I couldn't believe that I only heard her story in the last couple of weeks. She won the Special Recognition Award at the Irish Tattler Women of the Year Awards. So a pretty big deal and a really nice night. Unfortunately, I couldn't be there because I was working, but I made sure to catch up with all the inspiring women that came away with awards that night, and I came across Sarah. So I started to read about Sarah's story, and I just couldn't believe everything she's been through and what she has done since. So Sarah is a survivor of a very violent sexual attack. A stranger broke into her apartment in Dublin while she was sleeping back in 2019. And Sarah decided to speak publicly about her experience in the hope of highlighting how victims can better prepare for trials. And she's also calling for more open and understanding conversations in Ireland. And I know that you're just going to fall in love with Sarah. I absolutely did myself. She's so articulate, and just the way she spoke about dealing with her trauma, I think is going to help so many listeners today. And I hope that you enjoy this conversation and get something out of it. And thank you so much to Sarah for her time, her openness, her honesty, and just she's an incredible person. You'll see for yourself. Okay, so let's get into it. I'm Georgie Crawford. This is the Good Glow Podcast. Following a cancer diagnosis in my 30s, my goal is to inspire and empower people on their self-care journey. Through the conversations I have with my guests, we hope to do just that.
There is a plan, and believe that if you're at rock bottom and you're suffering, this is all part of your life, your tapestry. This is your story, and where you go next is what's crucial.
The love before was easy, but the love at my lowest was real.
We all know what makes us happy. We all know the life we dreamed about. And deep down, we all know what we're capable of if you only give yourself permission to do it.
I now live a happy and fulfilled life where self-care is the top priority and every day is an opportunity to grow. This season, I've teamed up with L'Oreal Paris. L'Oreal Paris Revitalift Pure Retinol Night Serum is their most potent retinol for deep wrinkles. Validated by the L'Oreal International Board of Dermatologists, it is loved by consumers and was awarded Best Retinol for 2021 by Grazia. Applying L'Oreal Pure Retinol Serum before your nighttime moisturizer can tackle the appearance of even deep wrinkles and brighten your skin. Revitalift is available in your local McCabe's pharmacy. Sarah, thank you so much for being a guest on the Good Glow today. I've been really looking forward to having this conversation. I've been reading all about your story, and I'm just so grateful to you for coming on to the Good Glow today.
Oh, thank you so much. I'm equally honoured to be on the show. I'm just really looking forward to speaking with you.
Sarah, you've had quite a few years. You've been on an incredible journey, and a journey of healing as well at the same time. And as we were talking during the week, and you spoke about, you know, that you're okay to now talk about everything that happened, and I admire you so greatly. And I know that you're going to, you are helping, and you will help so many people in the future. Can you tell us a little bit about your life before July 2019?
Sure. So I am half French, half Irish. You would never tell from the accent. I moved to Ireland for the first time in 2016 to train as a solicitor. And so during that time, got, you know, qualified as a solicitor, qualified as a yoga teacher as well. So I was doing kind of that little side gig on the side. And just, you know, really at that point in my life where my career was taking off, you know, traveling, making new friends. So it was kind of that world of possibilities and not knowing where I was going to go after the training contract was done. So yeah, just really in a place of, you know, a lot of excitement and things happening.
Tell us about your move to Ireland, and what was life like growing up for you in France?
So actually, I am what my father affectionately calls a bit of a mongrel. I didn't grow up just in France. We kind of moved around a lot. So we kind of grew up in Japan, funnily enough, for 6 years. I know, so random. Wow. but then in France as well. And then I did my university in London. So I guess my upbringing was always very international, you know, very much you're kind of coming into new cultures and not making assumptions about people and just kind of, you know, adapting to wherever you are. And then like London for me was just eye-opening. It was, you know, university, first time away from home. Like London is just magical. So like that was phenomenal. And then moving over to Ireland, like we used to come here for the summer holidays, which never really felt like which never really felt like summer, but you know, loved the Irish people and loved how warm and open and just how easily they would speak to you. And so when it came to kind of looking for a job, I was applying for jobs in London and in Ireland, and actually just kind of fell in love with Dublin and the Irish people. So made the decision to move here.
And, you know, in those kind of months leading up to your attack, do you look at your life now as a kind of before and after?
Yeah, 100%. In many ways, I feel like that was my old life. And like, this is very much my new life. Like, I'm no longer that Sarah. And I mean, anyone can say that about their life if they look back long enough, but it was my life did a 180 that night. And for a long time, I didn't know who I was. Like your whole, you know, like we'll probably get into the attack a little bit more later, but what happens in things like sexual assault and sexual violence and rape is, the core of your identity is struck, and you know, your sense of safety, your sense of identity, your how you relate to others, your relationships with your family and your friends, it's kind of all burnt down to the ground. And so you kind of have to rebuild from the ground up, and you decide what you want to keep and what you just kind of, you know, say goodbye to and leave behind. But certainly, yeah, like it's just night and day who I was before and who I am now.
And do you ever miss the person you were before?
Yeah, of course I do. Like I, you know, I loved that person, but I also love the person I am now. And you know, like I won't sugarcoat it, like there was a huge grieving process for myself, which sounds weird because, you know, the thing with again, sexual violence is there's no external markings. Like no one has passed away. You haven't really lost anything. And yet you feel almost dead inside for a long time. And that's the effect of, you know, what's been done to you, the impact on your identity, but also the impact of PTSD. And people's reaction to me was by far the worst thing, like by far worse than anything else. It was people withdrawing, people being afraid, the silence around it, and not being able to talk about this huge thing that had happened to you and turned your life around. And you're expected to, I guess, shut it down and, you know, not bring up such unpalatable conversations in polite society. That was really tough. So yeah, like I do, of course I miss her, but I've very much reached a point now where I've embraced my journey and my story and who I am now. And I wouldn't trade that for the world.
Oh, it's an amazing place to get to after such a trauma. And just what you were saying there about trauma, and you know, it's not like you lost somebody. It's almost, they're like invisible scars. And I think those invisible scars, when people are going through things, like you said, people don't know how to react. They don't know what to say. And I think that's why you are going to do so much amazing work, and you are doing so much amazing work, you know, writing your book or putting your story out there. You're helping other people. And I know during the week you spoke about future survivors. And when you said future survivors, it almost broke my heart, because of course there's future survivors of everything, you know, cancer, illness. When you think about, you know, there's so many people walking around and their life is in the before phase, and like you said, you know,
I have no idea.
Yeah, it's just very kind of hard to get your head around. But I think you're doing amazing work. So if you're comfortable, Sarah, would you mind taking us through what happened that night?
Yeah, sure. I might leave, like, you know, the details, because there's plenty online and I'm conscious of not triggering people or, you know, little ears listening in the background. But if you want the full story, Una's article on the Irish Times kind of goes into a lot of detail.
Okay.
But over a little 2 years ago now, so it was July of 2019, I was very violently sexually assaulted in my own home. And in a nutshell, a burglar basically broke into our apartment, into my bedroom window, in the dead of night. I think it was 3 a.m. or something, you know, on a Tuesday night. So I definitely was fast asleep. And I didn't hear him. I woke up with him on top of me and he was strangling me. So again, like, you know, I won't sugarcoat it. It was incredibly violent. There was a very violent fight for my life. And a violent sexual assault as well. So, you know, after that, I was in a state of shock and PTSD for months. And what was interesting to me is I almost erased the sexual violence aspect of it, because what had shocked me to my core was the kind of fight for my life and having nearly died. And, you know, that's one thing the movies get right, is your life, like your whole life just flashes in front of your eyes. Time seems to slow down. And my last thought was actually of my parents and my family, and thinking they're going to have to come in and clean out this room because I'm going to be dead. And, you know, after that, the adrenaline kicked in and I fought back. But it was... a very scarring experience, and it probably only lasted a handful of minutes at most. So after I escaped, I was able to grab my two flatmates and we escaped through the back of the apartment. And I think the perpetrator must have been arrested a couple of days or maybe even less than that. I'm not sure exactly when. So then kind of fast forward 2 years of, you know, a lot of PTSD and dealing with a lot of anger and, you know, people withdrawing and just trying to figure out what's happening in your life. The kind of second traumatic piece, and I don't say this lightly, I understand the weight of my words, like the trial experience to me was far, far worse than the attack. And, you know, like, I'm a lawyer, so I had some faith in our legal system and our criminal justice system. And I just was floored by how badly survivors are treated. And the problem is it's not down to any one person. Most people you deal with are actually lovely. It's just the system is absolutely broken. And I think people don't even know how broken it is, let alone how to fix it. So yeah, that's kind of my story.
And in those days after the attack, Sarah, did you stay in Ireland? Who was with you?
Yeah, so it was a funny one. So we went back to the flat after the kind of the police or the guards had cleared it out, and like there was no way I was staying in that room. I just could not be in that room. So I stayed with a friend or friends actually for one or two nights. And then my family was in Galway at the time. So they normally live in France, but they were kind of having a little summer holiday in Galway. So they, I didn't tell them the full extent of the story. I kind of gave them a very, very soft vanilla version of, you know, burglar broke in, I was assaulted, but I'm absolutely fine. Don't worry. So they kind of came.
Why did you give them that version?
I guess I was trying to protect them. And it was just such a, you know, like I remember waiting in the sexual assault clinic called SATU for, you know, they have to do the whole forensic medical examination. And I just remember being in that waiting room thinking, this can't have happened to me. This can't be happening. I'm so careful. You know, I'm careful when I walk home alone. I don't get myself in, you know, dangerous situations. Like, how could this have happened? So there was an element of, I didn't want to admit it. of course. But there was also, you know, I didn't like, I couldn't do it to my sister and my mother. I just couldn't. And I didn't know how I was going to react. So I didn't want to give them that fear. And then they're just there waiting, uncertain, not knowing what's going to happen. So I told myself, I'll wait and see how I react over the next few months. And then, you know, once I've got a handle on it, then I can tell them. And then I can say, you know, but it's over now. Which of course it didn't take a few months to get a handle on it. That was very wishful thinking. I didn't stay in that apartment. My family came down. I think it was the next day. It's a bit of a blur. I think it was the next day. And I kind of didn't tell them. I sort of let it very unclearly between the lines that something had happened. But, you know, I was being so careful not to show any weakness, because they were my pillars. So if they crumbled, I didn't know what I was going to do. So I just had to be strong to make sure that my pillars wouldn't crumble, which is crazy. But those are the kind of thoughts that go into your head when you're in shock and when you have PTSD. So, but we did something that was really important and I think can help other survivors, you know, with a healthy warning that every single survivor is so different. Every situation is so different. But what we did is they got an Airbnb in Dublin, kind of not too far from the flat, but close enough. And every day we just made a point of going back to the flat and, you know, having a cup of tea. Or the next day we kind of cleared the room was a complete mess because the fight had been so violent. So kind of just cleaning up the room a little bit, or, you know, throwing out the bed sheets and getting new beddings. Like every day, just a little bit of reclaiming, like those baby steps. And that's really how I approached my whole healing journey, was this beast is too big to tackle. So we're going to start with absolute small bite-sized chunks here. But then I remember, so it took me, I was back in the flat within 10 days, I think, maybe even less actually.
Living there
and my family living there. Yeah. So we were all back in it. Well, yeah, we were all back in it, but my parents were kind of, you know, despite only having the vanilla version, they were kind of begging me to stay longer. And I was just kind of saying, no, I need to get back to some form of normality. Like I can't, you know, let myself, just do nothing. So, I mean, I was back in work within, I think it was a week or 10 days, something crazy. I do not recommend. I mean, my boss in my job was great. And he was just, he was very clear that I was there, but I was not there to do work. It was more almost to just be around normality. And I think he gave me like the easiest task to do over a week if I wanted to do it, just to keep busy. Yeah. So, you know, it was that kind of thing of just, again, the bite-sized chunks of just, you know, coming back to normality. And I certainly don't say this to make it sound easy, because it's not, and it's also not linear. So, you know, I was back in work so quickly because I was still in shock. And then it kicked in, you know, a few months later, and that's when the meltdown started to happen.
Sarah, did you wonder if you knew this person in those days afterwards?
No. And the reason why, Georgie, is because I saw his face. Now, I know my mind kind of has blurred a lot of it, but I certainly remember like when I woke up trying to piece together again, like time slows down and you're trying to piece together, like, what is happening? Like, did I faint? Do I have a boyfriend that I've forgotten about? Like, there must be some rational explanation for this. This doesn't happen. And then I remember seeing his face and thinking, no, I absolutely do not know this man. And then you're kind of thinking, maybe I fainted and the electrician is waking me up and I think I'm being strangled and I'm completely, you know, like I'm going to come to my senses in 2 seconds and we'll all be laughing about this over lunch. But like that moment never happened. Like as horrific as my story was, I'm very conscious that I was one of the lucky ones because I didn't know him. Most survivors know their attacker. I didn't have to deal with seeing his friends, seeing his family, seeing him. You know, there was none of that. And the fact that he was caught so quickly, there was about a week where we didn't know if it was him. And they were able to identify him because I think I in the fight, I bit out a chunk of his hand. So they were, you know, they were quite certain it was him. But if I hadn't had that certainty, I would never have left my house again. Like I was just so, I was like, he knows what I look like and I've blurred it from my mind. What if I run into him in the shop? He knows where I live. You know, he knows the sound of my voice. like that, I just can't, you know, the survivors that do have that extra layer of trauma and repeated compounded trauma every day are, in my eyes, heroes.
Oh, absolutely. And you are a hero too, of course.
Oh, thank you so much.
So did you feel better then when he was caught?
100%. You know, like that was the fact that he was off the streets. And now they couldn't give me any details because, you know, there's that whole innocent until proven guilty and they have to formally arrest him. Like there's so much formality, which I knew, but I didn't actually, it didn't dawn on me the impact that that has on a survivor. And to be told so little, and you're like, but how do you know it's him? And they can't tell you. But yeah, like I kind of kept thinking, well, they must know it's him because of the bite mark. So that did make me feel safer. But then I did notice that, you know, as I was walking around town, I just didn't feel safe at all. So, you know, things like hearing people running behind me would absolutely trigger me, or someone just trying to, even a friend or a family member trying to reach out and touch my hand or hug me or anything like that, I would just absolutely go into a frenzy. I couldn't bear it. So there was a lot of other repercussions in my own life where all my markers and, you know, my familiar points were gone. I couldn't hug my mom anymore. I couldn't, you know, hold a friend's hand, or I just was constantly on alert that, you know, someone would just, you know, put their hand on my shoulder as a friendly gesture. And like I was constantly on alert for months. So that took a long time to go away.
And you speak about, you know, putting your feelings into that box and putting it up on the shelf. And you have done incredible work over the last couple of years on your healing journey. At what point do you think you took the box down and opened it?
Yeah, that's a great question. It certainly wasn't, you know, a eureka moment where it happened overnight. Mm-hmm. I guess it was, you know, again, a compounded effect of people weren't talking about this. And even some of my closest friends just didn't have the tools or didn't have the strength or whatever it is to address this. And, you know, I felt like I had to hide it in work. I probably didn't, but that's certainly how I felt. And so it was just months and months and months of feeling silenced and not being able to speak about it. And then you also have to think about if there's a trial, you just cannot speak about this, because if there's any, you know, anything released into the public eye, they can argue, well, he hasn't had a fair trial, which is fair. But so I guess over those months, I started to feel these feelings of guilt and shame and secrecy, and they started to fester. So like that box that I put away, like the insides of it started to rot. And I hit this point where I was like, I can't do this anymore. Like I'm wasting so much valuable energy that I should be investing in my healing, and I'm spending it covering up and hiding.
Yeah.
So obviously I couldn't start talking about it, you know, kind of too openly because, again, the trial and everything, but I tried to start embrace my journey in other ways. And I tried to just kind of switch my perspective a little bit. And again, it did not happen quickly or easily. It was a lot of trial and error, but I guess I started to invest into things that made me happy. So there's, you know, Jonathan Van Ness from Queer Eye talks about these pockets of joy, and they can be as small as getting yourself a little hot cup of coffee or a nice pastry or go for a walk or do something. And I was like, okay, I'm going to pack as much of these as I can into my day. And that all that energy I'm spending on hiding, I'm going to switch that energy and use it for me and be selfish. And, you know, this is my healing, even though I can't say what I'm healing from, you know, some people can guess, but I'm just going to focus on making a colorful breakfast bowl or, you know, putting a song on and having a little jig in my room, like whatever it is. And I was surprised how quickly that started to snowball. So initially, you know, you just get a peak of happiness and you're done. But you kind of keep going, and all of a sudden your day starts, like the whole perspective of your day shifts, where you wake up and you're like, what am I going to do to make me happy or give me a little moment of joy? And yeah, like that just that whole healing journey to me snowballed. And I mean, it could be anything that makes you happy. It is not too small. It is not too frivolous. Get it in, get plenty of them in, and just be selfish about them.
Wow. I have no words. Just what you were saying there, I don't think I've ever heard it described so well, that when you said the inside of that box had started to rot, and that's in you.
Yeah.
And you decided to address it and change that energy in your body by acknowledging what had happened and going down that healing journey. And like you said, not one part of it was easy, but there's so many people in the world that have that little box inside that's rotting, because it is so scary to unlock that, isn't it? And to kind of face those things that happened to you in the past. And I think I heard this story a couple of weeks ago, and someone had dealt with a trauma in their life, and it was 30 years ago. And the person who was trying to help them was saying, you know, you need to deal with this trauma. And they kept saying, you know, that happened 30 years ago. It's in the past.
Yeah.
And he said, it didn't happen 30 years ago. If you don't deal with it, it's happening to you every single day, over and over again.
That is so true. That's so well said. Yeah.
And just what you were saying there about the box rotting, that's it. And also what you said about, you know, choosing joy. I was speaking to my friend, Dr. Clodagh Campbell, at the start of this year, and she explained to me how you can cultivate joy in your life. And I thought joy was something you just stumbled across. So you can make time, like you were saying, go for the coffee, have a little pastry, making those time for a joyful moments, leaning towards joy as best you can really kind of put you on that path.
I'll get straight back to my conversation with Sarah, but first I wanted to thank L'Oreal Revitalift for supporting the Good Glow this season, and with their support I get to bring these really important conversations to you. It's only when I started to pay attention to looking after my skin that I discovered retinols and the importance of using retinol before bed. L'Oreal Paris Pure Retinol Night Serum leaves my skin feeling brighter and more evenly toned. I love reading reviews about products I'm using, and the words that jumped out at me for this retinol were glowy, smooth, and affordable. This award-winning anti-wrinkle serum is super concentrated, so it's recommended to start applying two nights a week, avoiding the eye area, and always using SPF the morning after. For a double dose of result, you can use it in combination with L'Oreal Paris Hyaluronic Acid Serum that will add plump and hydration to the skin. Now back to Sarah.
So, Sarah, you said that the trial was worse than the attack. Can you talk us through a little bit about what you went through in that process?
Yeah, sure.
And sorry, is it fair to say that because I don't want to put words in your mouth, but I thought you mentioned that to me.
Yeah, no, it absolutely is. I say this again and again. I guess I'll start by saying, like, you know, again, each survivor's journey is so different. And when I speak of my issues with the trial, I certainly don't mean to put off survivors going to get justice, because that's a decision you make internally. And it's a gut decision. Like, it's just, you know yourself, and you do not let any person tell you do it or don't do it. Like, that is for you to decide. Now, that's also, you know, taking into account that sometimes, you know, the DPP decides not to prosecute, and that decision is taken away from you. And I can't imagine the heartbreak of that. But, you know, in my own journey, it was just horrific. And I'm a lawyer, so again, I have some knowledge of the system that a lot of people might not. And I went in blind. I had no idea what was going to happen. It's dragged out for years. So my case took about a year and a half to get to trial. And they were saying, oh, that's record speed. This is almost unheard of. You know, normally the average is 2 to 3 years. 2 to 3 years of that box rotting because you cannot move past it. And your life has just stopped in its tracks. You're stuck in time. You can't move forward. You can't change jobs. You can't move countries because you are stuck waiting for this thing to happen. And they don't tell you what's going to happen. I think they're just so used to the system, and it's such an archaic Dickensian system. I mean, they're still wearing robes, for God's sakes. Like, it's just ridiculous. And they tell you nothing, and there's different pieces of information that you're trying to scrap together from, you know, the guards will say something, the DPP will say something, the Rape Crisis Center will say something, you'll see stuff online, you know, a friend will say something, and you're trying to piece it together. And more often than not, the information you're given is inaccurate or incomplete. And, you know, for me, there was two very critical things. One was I saw the man's face, but I didn't, my mind sort of erased it. So I was so terrified of being triggered by, you know, seeing him in open court. And I knew from my legal studies that you can ask for a screen to be put in between you and the attacker. And I had asked for this again and again and again, and had been told, oh, don't worry, you know, sexual offenses, you know, you can give evidence behind, you know, a video link. You don't even have to be in the room, blah, blah. That wasn't true. Turns out the video link is only for minors or people with a disability in certain cases. And the screen, we had to advocate until the very last day, not even the day trial started. Like, we got it secured the day before I went on the stand. And, you know, like, I remember walking into the courtroom the first day of trial, and you get to, you know, just see where you're going to sit and everything. If you ask for it, so always ask to be shown the room. And I looked at my seat, and then I saw where he was going to be seated. And I mean, we are in touching distance of each other. There is no glass between you. There's no barriers. There's, you know, it's like a little, he sits in a little box, I guess. Like, the separation goes up to maybe knee level or waist level or whatever it is. And, you know, that fear of having to think, I'm having to go on stand and convince 12 strangers of what's happened. It's my word against his. And I'm going to have to sit next to this creature who did this to me, and I will probably get a panic attack and not be able to string two words together and be traumatized, re-traumatized, probably for life. Like, I just don't understand why they can't just give you a decision then and there. And I completely understand balancing the interests of justice, and supposedly, you know, the screen can make the accused look guilty. I get that. But then if you make the screen automatic for every case, then it doesn't look guilty. Also, if I was accused, you know, unrightly of having raped someone, I wouldn't want to sit next to the person as they're spewing this story. Like, I would want a separation as well. So arguably it's for both. It's in the interest of both parties to have that. You know, and there was other things that I've talked about again that are in Una's article, like, they seized my counseling records without telling me they were going to do it. And there was, you know, stuff in there. Oh yeah. Under Irish law, they can use the victim's counseling records in sexual offense cases, and they don't use it to back what you're saying. They use it to disprove what you're saying. So if there's any discrepancy between anything you've said in your statement and then what you've said in counseling, in the privacy and, you know, security of a counseling room with a professional, they can take all of that. And the prosecution gets to read it. The prosecution team, I might add, the defense team, and the accused, and they all get to read it. They redact some parts that supposedly don't relate to the trial, but you don't get to see what they redact. And it's all used against you. And I remember going in to see the notes before they were taken. You don't have a choice in this, by the way. Like, you can fight it, but, you know, it'll just go to hearing, and more likely than not, they will get the notes off you. I remember reading the notes, and there was a line in there that my therapist had written down that said, you know, Sarah doesn't want the accused to know what he's done to her, because, you know, he might get some,
yeah,
you know, some smugness out of it or whatever it is. And, you know, she doesn't want him to know the impact it's had on her life. He got to read that.
So he got to read what you said in private to your counselor.
Yep. Yeah. So that was very much one of the pieces that, you know, to me just broke the camel's back. And I went public in big part because of that, because I remember survivors coming to me after I went public about this, and, you know, put recommendations to the justice minister to change this absolutely barbaric Dickensian law. And survivors telling me, I either didn't go to trial because of this, Or I didn't get therapy for years because of this stupid rule. And now if this guy had come into my room and hadn't sexually assaulted me, but had, you know, strangled me and, you know, brutally attacked me and the attempted murder, there'd be no, they wouldn't be able to take my notes. No way. So it's just for sexual offenses because there's this underlying, you know, thought still in our criminal justice system that women and, you know, men victims are lying. And in other countries like the US and Australia, they have a thing called rape shield laws. So that's basically say you are not allowed to go digging into the victim's past, her note or his notes, nothing. You take the facts that happened on the night or the day of the rape or the sexual violence, and that is it. In the same way that you do not go digging into the accused's history. You know, you can, like, if he had been on the sexual offenders register, pretty sure they can't bring that up. So it's complete, like the whole justice system, I don't know how we got to this stage, but it is so heavily loaded against victims from beginning to end. And that's without going into, you know, the fear of people have of reporting it and not being believed, and the fear of prosecution, not prosecuting because there's not enough facts, like all of those hurdles you have to go through to get justice. And then you have to wait for years. And more often than not, it gets delayed. Like mine nearly got delayed for a year, my trial. So that would have been another year. And I had to fight that one tooth and nail and eventually did. But you have to, you know, for a system that's designed to defend society, it's very much going after victims in my eyes.
And did he put up much of a fight, Sarah?
So no, and it was again a very unusual situation in that he wasn't an Irish native. I think English wasn't even his mother tongue, so he didn't really understand what was going on, I think. And my understanding from the defense counsel was he admitted to all the facts but just refused to plead guilty. And we got to this crazy situation where the person has admitted all of it, but because of the formalities we have that somebody needs to plead guilty, and he was in such, you know, mistrust of the system, he didn't. So he probably suffered like crazy as well, because he, you know, had to sit through 2 weeks of this horrendous trial. And I think he was getting very agitated towards the end. And to be honest, like, I mean, I don't think for either of us, the experience was in any way positive. And we could have been spared all of that if, you know, if there was just a little bit more common sense in our justice system.
Did you ever find out if he had been following you or stalking you, or was this just a kind of a random encounter?
It sounds like it was completely random. I mean, he had burgled 3 other places that night. And then, you know, the night after burgled another place. And I think there was a girl, in the room where he broke into, and, you know, luckily nothing happened, but she was still, and completely understandably so, extremely traumatized and so young. So I remember when I found this out, I was just weeping that, you know, he could just have continued doing this. And, you know, I like the in my situation, I fought back, but I could have not fought back. And, you know, you just don't know what's going to happen. So it's, yeah.
Did you feel supported when you told your story?
Oh my God. When I went public, I'm still reeling from it. Like, the support was incredible. I had no idea like this was going to happen. It honestly made all of it worth it. And I just was just high on love for days and days, and people reaching out that I, you know, hadn't spoken to before or had lost sight of. And I went forward thinking, you know, I'll make a little bit of noise in the DPP office and the criminal justice system and, you know, the Justice Department. But I didn't expect, you know, people like us to reach out. And the fact that they did and the things they said, I mean, I carry all those words with me every day.
Wow.
And that was such a huge part of my own healing journey. Yeah. You know, again, every person's different. People may not want to talk about it, but I was so humbled by it all. And it kind of, when I went public, it followed a couple of articles that come out in the weeks before that obviously couldn't name me because I hadn't waived anonymity then, but everybody who knew the story knew it was me. And people, you know, how many women do you know wake up with a man on top of them strangling them on a Tuesday night? Like, that story is shocking. People talk about it, but people didn't know about the sexual assault. And those articles went into such gruesome detail, and it was just such a just pure shock value, really. And I felt like my story had been stolen from me. Yeah. And at this stage, you know, my story was stolen from me. I'd been through hell. This man now knew my face because despite the screen, there was one incident where they forgot the screen and I saw him and he saw me. So I had nothing to lose then. I was like, well, I might as well use this to help people and, you know, put my mouth where my money is and, you know, practice what I preach and put my face out there as well and show we have nothing to feel, you know, guilty about or ashamed of. This happens to so many people. Like, the Rape Crisis Center has published, I think it's the Rape Crisis Center has published figures for 2020. And it's, you know, in their lifetimes in Ireland, 50% of Irish women and 20% of Irish men will experience sexual violence. That's not sexual assault or harassment, that's sexual violence. So this affects a lot of people, and we need to start talking about it openly. Like, this is not something to be afraid of.
When you decided to go public, what's that process like? Do you have to find someone you trust to tell your story? Did you have support there?
I love that you ask this question, because I thought, you know, the courts are always talking about waiving anonymity and whatever that means. And I thought, you know, because they talk about it so much, there must be a process. There isn't. So it's exactly that. You decide how you're going to do it. Like, do you do it by social media? Do you find someone you trust? Do you find a you know, like a newspaper that wants to do your story? Like, do you go on an interview? How do you do it? But the thing is, and it's something I was conscious of, but I took a lot of time to think about before I went public, is once your story is out there, you have no control over how it's going to be reshared, how the public is going to react to it, how people are going to comment on it. And, you know, if you release only a part of your story, people might find something else out there and put the two together. So that's why, like, Una Mullally in the Irish Times was just phenomenal. And she guided me through the process. And I know that she's done this for other women. Like, she really is a champion of women, and had, you know, so much professionalism. She was so gentle, but so open and calm and not afraid. And she was explaining, you know, again, once these things go public, these are the things you want to think about, and, you know, think about how it affects your family as well. Now, that in itself shouldn't be a reason to go public or not, but it's something to think about. And just, how do you prepare yourself? You know, close down all your social media, you know, do checks online to see, is your address out there? Can people, you know, turn up at your, like, people were sending me letters to work. So it's just, you know, things to think about. And it's stuff that I actually address in my book. So I kind of, the book that's coming out in March is very much like a survival guide to help survivors. And I do it by topic. So, you know, everything from the day one of the assault all the way through to your healing journey. And one of the chapters is on going public and all the things you want to think about that I hadn't fully appreciated at the time, kind of all bundled into a neat little checklist.
Wow, it's amazing for writing that book, and I can't wait to read it.
Thank you so much.
Did you get an apology?
No, and to be honest with you, I didn't need one.
That wouldn't have helped you heal. It just didn't matter to you, did it not?
No, it didn't. And it's kind of going back to that box and, you know, the kind of rotting insides. That's yours. That's in you.
Yeah.
There's nothing anybody else could have done to make me feel better. I had to do the work. You know, I had all this anger to deal with. I had all this worry and sadness to get through. But the public reaction was just phenomenal. But I don't think I would have, you know, received it in the same way if I hadn't done my work on my healing for those 2 years. And you know, all the kind of the stuff that was happening in the background. So no, I really don't need an apology. And if anything, what I do need and what I do want is to make sure this doesn't happen again to other survivors. So that's the whole aim behind the book, which was quite difficult to write because it's still quite fresh, I guess, but it's just arming survivors and also their friends, their families, their colleagues, just society at large to, one, know what's up, you know, what you're up against, to realize you're not alone, other people are going through this, and to have some kind of a, okay, well, I don't know how to tackle this, it's so big, but let's start with, you know, 101, this checklist is telling me, you know, light a candle and pour a hot bath, or this checklist is telling me when the guards come for the criminal investigation, these are the things you need to watch out for. Or, you know, after, like immediately after the assault, if you can, these are the things to do to preserve the evidence on you and go straight to the, you know, sexual assault clinic, like all these things to kind of break it down step by step. And, you know, like, again, not to make it sound easy, because it's really not. And I had it easy in a lot of ways. I had so much support. You know, I had some knowledge of the justice system. And, you know, I was in a situation where there was no...
Yeah, I was just going to say you were believed.
Yeah, I mean, it was a Tuesday night, you know, it wasn't like I was on a date in a bar or whatever, but I very much could have been.
Yeah.
And even in my situation where there was no data on consent, I felt guilt and shame. So we need to stop this. Like, this is just not helpful to kind of think, oh, well, you know, what were they wearing or what were they drinking or where were they or blah, blah. Like, it just, it's not helpful to say it to yourself. And, you know, I was blaming myself, thinking I didn't, you know, properly check the window to make sure it was safe. Like, you just beat yourself up about these things that you're wasting valuable energy doing. Yeah. It. And you're, of course, not going to be able to stop entirely. But I'm hoping we're going to be able to shift our perspective. And to be honest with you, we already are. Like, I'm floored by people's reaction and how open and honest and forward they were, and just reaching out and putting themselves out there, because it's not easy to reach out to someone when you don't know how they're going to react. And it's not easy if you haven't been through it to say, you know, I'm so sorry, or, you know, I'm so, you know, proud of you, or whatever it is. So, you know, those people, they've already started the movement. Like, it's in motion. We just need to, like, keep it going and keep the pressure on and just keep up the good work.
Was there a standout moment for you over the last 2 years in your healing journey, or something that kind of turning point for you? Or I know you're still very much in it.
Yeah. Oh God, there's so many. I guess, like, the yoga to me was, I still say to this day, like, it really saved my life. And it was something I'd been, you know, I was a trained yoga teacher, so I kind of had the building blocks for the resilience and everything. And we've talked about this before, where, you know, when I say, oh, yoga can help, the immediate reaction is, well, I'm not flexible enough, or I can't do a headstand or whatever. Mm-hmm. But the good news is, you don't need to bend yourself into a pretzel to do yoga. And, like, yoga for me was the very, very beginning of my healing, where it was kind of, number one, getting, you know, into a state of awareness of myself and my feelings and my body and what had happened, and two, kind of combat these elements of PTSD, like dissociation. So a very common thing when you're going through something like this is, you feel detached from reality, and you feel like, I remember thinking what's happening around me is like a video game or something. It's not real. Like, I literally remember looking at traffic and saying, I could just jump into that and come out unscathed. Like, nothing seems real. It's such a strange situation, and it can translate into your body as well. So I'd look at my hands and think, but this is so weird. Like, I know they're mine. My head knows they're mine, but they don't feel like they're mine. So in my yoga practice initially, I would literally just, you know, sit or, you know, get down on my yoga mat and put my hands down against the mat and kind of just spread my fingers out wide and press my palm down into the mat and just feel that kickback into my palms and just feel the muscle in, you know, my forearm or the joint in my elbow or my shoulder, whatever it is. And that was my practice for weeks of just rediscovering my body and feeling my body. And, you know, that again, like the other pockets of joy, started to snowball where, you know, I started with that. And then I started getting my physical strength back. And as I got my physical strength back, I kept thinking, well, maybe, you know, I can do basically anything I put my mind to. And then my mental strength started coming back as well. And every time you conquer a scary pose, like for me, even as a yoga teacher, I hated inversions, like, you know, headstands, handstands. The first time I conquered a headstand, that was just like, oh my God, I can do this. I can do this. And it's all coming from me. And that's what kind of yoga cultivated. And I still have that, you know, like I've cultivated so much of that through the busy warrior and just trying to pass that on to people. And whatever level you're at, whoever you are, that connection with your body, with your mind is such a powerful tool, and it can unlock so much for you.
Wow, that's amazing. And that's the thing with yoga, isn't it? It isn't just physical. Like you were saying, the physical, it leads to the mental. And then you're like, I can do this. You know, I can.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's incredibly powerful. And I know so many people who go through traumas, you know, find their peace with yoga or find their solace. Julie B, I had on my podcast a few seasons ago, was attacked by an ex-boyfriend, and she just turned to her mat and got her through the toughest days.
It is magical. There's like kind of the Bible on trauma, which is written by, and I'm going to butcher his name, Dr. Van de Kolk. So it's called The Body Keeps the Score. And for anybody going through trauma, yeah, whether it's, you know, physical trauma, you know, sexual violence, any trauma at all, really, I highly recommend this book because it breaks down the anatomy of trauma. And he has a whole chapter on yoga. And I mean, they do MRI scans, they, you know, do therapy, they check in with survivors, and those that, you know, turn to yoga, it's honestly magical. And I know some people say, oh, yoga's not for me, and I completely respect that. But I would also say every teacher is so different. So if you do yoga with me, you may hate it, and then you might do it with someone else and then love it. So I would recommend just trying it out, and you don't have to do an hour. It can be like a 5-minute YouTube video or whatever, but just kind of building up again that habit of creating joy, creating self-awareness, creating that moment of connection with yourself. And you do that over and over and over, and just things start to happen, magical things start to happen to you.
The second time in 2 weeks that I've heard someone speak about that book, The Body Keeps the Score. So I'm going to take that as my sign that I need to order it and read it.
So there's a lot of hope, I think, around trauma. And I think that's probably the reason why people don't talk about it or shut down, is because we think it's a death sentence, and it can be. Certainly, I feel like my old life is gone, but it's also incredibly hopeful, and it can get you to places that you never thought you would have done in your previous life, because that fear is just gone. So you've got nothing left to lose then. And you're like, well, why was I so afraid of, you know, going for the dream job, or, you know, starting my own business or doing my own podcast or whatever it is?
Unresolved trauma is holding us back.
100%. And it, you know, it's not a competition. You don't have to be raped to be a trauma victim. You don't have to, you know, be a survivor. Like like people go through trauma every day.
Yeah.
COVID has been traumatic for a lot of people.
Yeah.
And, you know, people don't acknowledge that. And then it builds up, and all of a sudden people are like, I'm depressed, I'm anxious. Well, I'm like, but yeah, I'm not surprised. And, you know, you've been a warrior and a trooper, but you need to address this.
Yeah. Oh, wow. And I think conversations are starting to happen a lot more around trauma. I think, you know, it's certainly a huge thing to kind of overcome. But I think for a lot of people, it's time. It's time to address 100%. That unresolved trauma. And I think, you know, especially through the GoGlow community, like there's so much support. There's so many people doing the work. And there's so much support there as well. Sarah, when you look to the future now, and I know that you're doing incredible work, you've spoken to Helen McEntee, are you hopeful? And also, do you think, you know, as you started out in your practice, that you were meant to do that so that you can help make change?
Yeah,
sorry, so many questions there in one.
No, they're all brilliant questions. I'm like, which one do I answer first? I get so hopeful. Yes, 100%. And, you know, having spoken to the DPP office and Helen McEntee and, you know, all of the people in the Rape Crisis Center, and there's loads of other organizations getting involved, they're all behind this, you know, like those meetings were all super positive. Even, you know, speaking to the guards or whatever, they're all behind this. Yeah. Like they all want this to change. that, you know, we're probably still figuring out how and how much of an overhaul it's going to be. I really don't think it has to be that big of an overhaul at all. It's, there's a couple of provisions that I've outlined in my open letter to her that need to go. That shouldn't be a lot of work. And then, you know, training for barristers and things like that, that will take more time. But I certainly think we've got the public backing, and that's the most important piece of it, you know. And the fact that, you know, like powerhouses like you are asking people like me to talk about this means there is a real genuine public interest in this going the right way. And, you know, I'm, in many ways, I'm so proud to be Irish, because we've achieved so much change to become more progressive in recent years. Like, you look at all the referendums we've had, or, you know, all the movements that we've had and the conversations we're starting to have in such a short period of time. I mean, we're a great country and we're capable of great things. And certainly now that I've seen the public reaction, I think there's no obstacles left. Like, this has to happen. The only thing is we just need to keep the pressure on. But I don't think that's going to go, because, you know, there's people like me coming forward most days, if not every day.
Wow, Sarah, I have so much respect for you. Thank you for sharing your story on the Good Glow today, and I'll be reading your book. I'll be following your journey from now on. You're doing amazing things, so thank you for your incredible work, and I'm wishing you so much love and happiness going forward.
Thanks so much, Georgie, and just thank you so much for having me on the show. And, you know, just being a part of the Good Glow community is just incredible. And you've been so easy to speak to and to bring all this out. Like, I was a bit nervous about it, but it's just been such a pleasure. So thank you so much, and thank you for the work you do, and, you know, amplifying all the voices that need to be heard. Oh,
thank you, Sarah.
Thanks for listening to the Good Glow podcast, brought to you with thanks to L'Oréal Paris. I'm so happy to let you know that you can now gift our wellness course this Christmas. If you head over to the voucher section over on thegoodglow.ie, you'll be able to add in your friend or loved one's email address and pick a date for delivery. So that's over on thegoodglow.ie. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate and review, and I'll see you next week.